Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and once again it's my pleasure and privilege to present Wesley J. Smith, the co-author of four different titles with Ralph Nader, and most importantly, the author of Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder, published in hardcover by Times Books, copyright 1997. Wesley, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Well, thank you very much.
We're talking about The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder, and in analyzing Proposition 16, a piece of pioneering legislation from what you properly call, in my opinion, the death lobby, you talk about not only the very tricky language and the deliberate deceptions, but how this concept of killing people has been marketed as somehow progressive or even humane. The opponents of euthanasia have been very cleverly portrayed by its advocates as religious fanatics, dupes of the Vatican, etc. Would you develop that for us?
Yeah. It's very interesting that the people most obsessed about religion in this issue are the proponents, the supporters of assisted suicide and euthanasia. When you make arguments that are very empirically based and ethical and moral in nature and materialistic, as Forced Exit does, you know, I don't make religious arguments against assisted suicide and Forced Exit at all. They're all rational, materialistic arguments based on empirical investigation and to determine what is best public policy. But they want to try to cast this whole issue as a religious one. And they've got a reason for that. First off, if it's a religious issue, as opposed to a public policy issue, then people who oppose them don't have a right to a point of view in the sense that, of course, they have a right to their own point of view, but because we have a separation of church and state, they say that any attempt to stop this, what they call a rational choice issue, is religious-based, and therefore we don't have the right to impose our religious views on the rest of a secular, pluralistic society, yada, 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 right? The second reason to make cast that aspersion is if people are thinking, oh, it's just religious, I don't want to have to impose my religion on others or have their religion imposed on me, then people will not take the next step, which is to look at the arguments that are being made on the pro side to test them and see if they're valid. In fact, they're not valid. And the religious fanatic or fundamentalist or religious right aspersion is meant to be a big smokescreen to keep people from grappling with the issues itself. It's just a way of changing the subject instead of dealing with the actual facts of the case. Now, that is very effective. One of the reasons I spoke with a rational opponent of the Dutch euthanasia when I researched Forced Exit, a man named Dr. Vandersloos, who is an agnostic, is not a member of any religious belief or faith system. And he said one of the reasons that euthanasia was quickly accepted by the Netherlands is that proponents were able to depict opponents as religious fundamentalists. And since most Dutch people don't want to be thought of as religious fundamentalists, they accepted it. But you see, that's anti-intellectual. You see that happening today, that mm-hmm. someone will say, well, the religious right opposes assisted suicide, so I have to support it because I hate the religious right. Well, that's anti-intellectual. That's refusing to take a look at an issue and check out the facts, pros and cons, and so forth. I mean, if Jerry Falwell says no to something, it doesn't mean the answer is automatically yes.
Mm-hmm.
And to allow Jerry Falwell to have the kind of power where if he takes one position, you automatically take the opposite, I think is to abdicate your responsibility as a thinking free American.
You also point out, and this is not a point I want to linger on, that many of the Dutch proponents of euthanasia say that they think it would be a terrible idea in the United States with our health care system.
Oh yeah, that is something that gets washed over very quickly by proponents in this country. They point to the Dutch as an example they wish for us to emulate, but they don't tell people that the Dutch who support it in their own country think it would be terrible here because of our materialistic healthcare system, one that is based on profit, because of the very many ways in which our society is rent asunder based on the divisions of race or gender or sexual orientation and so forth, which do not occur in the Dutch society. Dutch society is pretty homogeneous. So the biggest proponents of euthanasia in the Netherlands are no longer invited to the United States, according to them, when I interviewed them, because the story they would have for this country is don't do it until you fix your society. And, of course, euthanasia proponents in this country aren't interested in hearing that message.
There was a column, an op-ed column that you had in the Wall Street Journal of November 25th of 1998, Wesley, entitled "A Snuff Film Comes to Primetime," and this is about Dr. Kevorkian's appearance, his murder of a Lou Gehrig's disease patient on 60 Minutes. And in the text of this article, you touch on one of the most important aspects of forced exit. In fact, you have an entire chapter named after this, which is euthanasia as a form of social oppression. Develop that for us, if you would.
Well, what euthanasia is doing is saying that there are certain lives not worthy to be lived. And we are saying that we should not have a unified system of law and ethics about killing, but a bifurcated one. That if one is healthy, young, vital, and wish to commit suicide or be killed, that, of course, we would never do that because, you know, they might change their mind. We've got to find ways to help them go forward. Police officers are empowered to use non-deadly force to stop suicide, for example. Of course, using deadly force would kind of miss the point. If somebody is suicidal, they can be hospitalized even against their will to help them go and through that crisis until they're able to go forward with life. There are many, many people out there, perhaps some people who are listening to this program, who would be dead today, but that a loving, compassionate, and caring society prevented them from self-destructing. Now, what assisted suicide and euthanasia is saying is that, well, yes, we will keep that policy for people who we perceive to have lives worth living, i.e., the person, or e.g., the person who wants to kill themselves because their business has collapsed, or because they've been humiliated in public, or because they've lost their children to death. We will try to keep those people going because those are lives worth living. However, if the person has cancer, or the person is a paraplegic or a quadriplegic because of an injury, or the person has ALS, or the person has multiple sclerosis or renal difficulties and want to kill themselves, we will no longer engage in that prevention, that life protection, that we would if that same person wanted to kill themselves for reasons other than health or disability. We will say, well, of course you don't want to live. You've got cancer. Or of course you don't want to live. You've got multiple sclerosis. I wouldn't want to live in that condition either. And rather than helping them through the crisis, which, by the way, may not even have anything to do with the disability. May have actually something to do, like, I've been left by my husband, but I'll say I want to die because I'm in a wheelchair. Well, then we'll say, well, let me hold your coat and let me make sure that your suicide is facilitated instead of prevented. Well, that's the very definition of oppression. Let's take a look at Jim Crow laws. Jim Crow laws basically said that blacks were inferior to white, and there was a two-tiered system of protection under the law. What, blacks had to use different restrooms, for example, separate but supposedly equal, which of course was inherently unequal schools. Now, the law reflected the value system of the South and the Jim Crow laws, which said that blacks are inferior to whites. But the law also sent a very powerful message, those Jim Crow laws, that said that racism was acceptable. And so even though vigilante lynchings were technically murder in the South, they were carried out with little consequence, if any consequence, partially because the law of the South said that there was a two-tiered system of justice and oppressing blacks was okay. The same thing will happen if we create a two-tiered system based on health or based on ability and disability. And not only will people be allowed to ask for assisted suicide and euthanasia, but if people do it against consent, there will be little outcry, as there is in the Netherlands. There's no outcry when doctors kill patients who don't ask for it, because these are lives not worth living. That's the message of the assisted suicide law. If we refuse desired medical treatment under futile care theory, F-U-T-I-L-E, which is happening in American hospitals today, people who are dying or people who are profoundly disabled who want treatment are having it refused based on the doctor's perception of the quality of life of the patient, a life not worth living, then, well, if we can kill them, if they want to be killed, then we don't have to treat them because we don't want to spend the money on these lives that are not worthy of being lived. Indeed, you can go beyond the futile care theory into involuntary killing, which has already happened in at least two cases that I'm aware of, in cases where people tried, where medical treatment was refused, and when the patient didn't die, the doctor killed the patient. There was a case in San Francisco of a girl who was given a lethal injection, and a case in Washington playing out now where a doctor put his hand over a premature baby's mouth and killed the baby. When the doctor was brought up on charges, the DA who brought that charge was kicked out of office by the voters. It's very, very frightening.
Futile care, F-U-T-I-L-E, could ultimately lead to futile care, F-E-U-D-A-L, if
it
we're not
is.
Careful. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what futile care theory is designed to do, by the way, this is not an end, it's beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It is trying to create a principle that says that the doctor's first and only obligation is not to the patient, that the doctor also has other obligations, i.e. distributive justice, society's desires, and so forth. Once the principle is established that doctors can say, no, we're not going to give this treatment because we don't believe it's beneficial or appropriate based on our value system instead of the patient's, then you can start, as the medical literature shows, the bioethics literature, cutting back on care that is beneficial, but doctors don't think that the patient should receive it, for example, treatment for elderly people. You have to understand one very important point in futile care theory, also known as inappropriate care or non-beneficial care. It isn't the treatment that is considered futile. It's the patient.
Mm-hmm.
The treatment, if a true futile treatment would be such as if you came to a doctor with an ear infection saying, give me an appendectomy. The doctor should refuse that because the appendectomy won't help the ear infection and, in fact, will harm you. But if you go to a doctor and say, you know, I want CPR even though, I've got a terrible disease and the CPR may only give me an extra 3 weeks of life, and the doctor says no, well, that's the doctor imposing his value system that your 3 weeks of life that you want that the CPR might get you isn't worth the money being spent on it or because your life isn't worth it. And that is, I think, a form of fascism. You're allowing the authority figure to impose their values on you. Bioethics has always been about, since the last 20 years, about autonomy, saying people have the right to die. If you don't want CPR, you shouldn't have to have it, and I agree with that. If you don't want a feeding tube, they also said, even though you're not terminally ill, we should be able to take it from you because if you're in a cognitively disabled state or if you're a quadriplegic, your life isn't worth living. So based on autonomy, which we have to respect, we'll do that too, even though we know it's going to lead to death as it would anybody else who was deprived of food influence. But now they're saying autonomy has its limits if you want the feeding tube, if you want the CPR, because it isn't autonomy that's the point, it's death that's the point.
Indeed. Turning to some of the marketability considerations with regard to euthanasia, I think a lot of people are afraid, and not unjustifiably, of sitting around or lying around and running up enormous medical bills for no particular reason. And yet you point out that under the HMO system, they're far more likely to have treatment withheld that they need than to have futile treatment administered at a great cost.
Well, people are afraid of being hooked up to machines against their will. That's the term. And there was a reason for that. It used to happen all the time. Why did it happen all the time? Our values follow our pocketbooks. When people were hooked up to machine against their will, when the medical ethic, prevailing medical ethic, was keep people alive at all costs, that's just coincidentally happened to occur at a time when we had fee-for-service medicine, and money and profits were made for each service that was provided. So if somebody was hooked up to a respirator for 6 months, even if they wanted it shut off, the hospital got to charge every day. And you remember the old joke. He's hooked up to the machine until either he dies or his health insurance runs out.
Mm-hmm.
That used to happen. And people were righteously concerned about that because nobody should have to receive that kind of care if they don't want it. People have a right not to have unwanted bodily intrusions. Those days are long gone and shall never return. We now have managed care where money is made from cutting costs. And it's no coincidence that we have gone from a prevailing medical ethic under fee-for-service that keep people alive at all costs to now we have to allow people to die with dignity. We should not extend the dying process, whether the people want it or not, because our values follow our pocketbooks. But people are still back. People don't process that. People come to their life's opinions based on their experiences. And they've seen people 5, 10, 15 years ago being hooked up to machines against their will, and so that's what they're afraid of. not a lot of people yet have seen care refused that they want, although it's beginning to happen, so that doesn't ring a chord because it's not part of their experience. But listeners have to pay very close attention. The chances of you being hooked up to machines against your will are declining by the day. The chances of you not receiving medical treatment you want based on the healthcare system's value system is increasing by the day. And there's going to come a time when you're going to have to perhaps even hire a lawyer to go to a hospital if you're very sick to make sure you get the treatment you want. And I'm not exaggerating. That time is here now for a few people, but eventually it's going to be here for the many, assuming that we don't have laws passed that allow this feudal care theory to go into formal practice. There is currently a legislation in New York that would allow feudal care to be formalized in statute. And that is truly frightening. But the media is paying no attention. We're all caught up in Monica, or we're caught up in the death of Princess Di or Jerry Springer. Meanwhile, this stuff is happening very quietly, but very carefully constructed and with malice aforethought.
Another fear that is attendant upon that same marketability of the youth of the pro-euthanasia people is the considerations attendant upon PVS, or persistent vegetative state. You discuss that and point out, among other things, that a Dr. Fortanese, am I pronouncing the name right?
Fortanese,
who's an expert on brain damage and ills of that kind, points out that 80 to 90% of the time, doctors misdiagnose that, 80 to 90% of the time.
And the studies have shown that even cases where the diagnosis has been well made in the sense of the right doctors making it, within 3 years, people with persistent vegetative state, 54% of them, have become conscious.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the cop who was shot in the head and was considered in persistent vegetative state? 7 years later, he started to talk?
Right.
So these things occur, but we don't want to think about those occurring because they complicate the law. Right now, if somebody in 50 states in this country, if somebody is diagnosed in a persistent vegetative state, if the caregiver wants to cut off their food and fluids, they're not terminally ill. All they need to continue living is warmth and food and fluids and turning to prevent pneumonia and bed sores. But if a family member or caregiver decides to cut off food and water through a tube, it'll be done based on autonomy, and in every state that is acceptable. They're now trying, through a lot of cases, their conscious people are also being dehydrated to death. If the family does not object, then if a family member does this to a profoundly cognitively disabled person, that is happening in nursing homes and hospitals throughout this country today. The only time these things make the news is if there's a case, if there's a family division and somebody resorts to a court. There was a recent case called Hugh Finn back in Virginia, in which a judge determined that Hugh Finn was in a persistent vegetative state and allowed his wife to dehydrate him to death. There was some, I thought, interesting evidence that he wasn't in a persistent vegetative state, but the judge ruled otherwise and so forth. There's a case in Stockton, California, of a man named Robert Wendland. Robert Wendland was in an unconscious state for 16 months. He then woke up.
Mm-hmm.
He got to the point where he could maneuver an electric wheelchair down a hospital corridor. He could do simple functions such as taking pegs out of a pegboard on request and putting it back, taking a ball, handing the ball back to the therapist, and so forth. Wife decided to dehydrate him, and he would have been dehydrated. The Ethics Committee of the Lodi Memorial Hospital approved it unanimously, but a nurse was very upset, and she blew the whistle anonymously, and the sister and mother found out and filed a lawsuit.
Wesley, let me interrupt ever so briefly to repeat something that I read from your book in our last interview. Dr. William Burke, who's an expert on death by dehydration, points out what this process is like, and bear in mind that this is being marketed as compassion.
It's being marketed as compassionate and also painless and perhaps even pleasant. But imagine how you would feel if you were put in a room and locked in for 3 weeks and given no food and water. Tell me it would be pleasant.
This is the description from Forest Exit, and you quote here Dr. William Burke. A conscious person would feel it, dehydration, just as you or I would. They will go into seizures. their skin cracks, their tongue cracks, their lips crack. They may have nosebleeds because of the drying of the mucous membranes, and heaving and vomiting might ensue because of the drying out of the stomach lining. They feel the pangs of hunger and thirst. They feel the pangs of hunger and thirst. Imagine going one day without a glass of water. Death by dehydration takes 10 to 14 days. It is an extremely agonizing death, and something that, as you point out, is now absolutely legal. In connection with the whole PVS issue, too, Wesley, you point out that a British study found that a great many patients who were diagnosed as PVS, in fact, were conscious, but because of the trauma, because of the pathology, they simply couldn't communicate.
Right.
It's almost like Edgar Allan Poe's The Cask of Amontillado, you know,
yes.
Where... just imagine, for people who are advocating this and say, well, you know, I don't want to suffer, I don't want to run up bills, et cetera, you've been diagnosed as a persistent vegetative state, but you are conscious, but you can't communicate, and then somebody, whether the physician or your relatives, decide that that description that you just heard is how you're going to die, and that's how you go.
There was a recent case in England of that occurring, and the person was able to hear everything that was going on, and luckily for her, she came conscious before the dehydration occurred. And she was furious because she felt she was about to be murdered.
And quite correctly.
Well, that's, I mean, under the law, it's not correct. Under the law, this is ethical. Of course, if you did it to a horse, Dave, you'd go to jail for cruelty to animals.
Right.
But we can do it to people based on issues of autonomy and based on cognitive disability because we have decided that these are lives not worthy of life.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, it is not only happening to unconscious people, but conscious people, if the family wants it. When somebody is that disabled and with brain damage requiring a feeding tube, the pressure on families to dehydrate from doctors, social workers, and even clergy is astonishing to behold. Based on, remember, our value systems have changed because our pocketbooks have changed.
Right. One thing we might point out, too, in connection with the whole issue of economics, obviously the economically disadvantaged, those without insurance, with access to inferior care, are going to be most at risk, and you point that out
here. Of course.
At the same time, in discussions on this issue on my talk show in Northern California, on my home base station, I refer to the euthanasia issue and the assisted suicide and the slippery slope as an equal opportunity destroyer, because even wealthy people who find themselves in a serious state of physical disrepair, and sooner or later, we all do, are going to be in a position where if they have wealth, their relatives, who will be in a position to rule on whether or not they get terminated, might want to get their hands on that wealth. You might want to touch on that and also the issue of advanced directives, Wesley.
Well, it's very interesting. Obviously, money, I've been practicing, I don't practice law much anymore, but back in my days when I was practicing a lot, I sometimes had some will contests, and I saw some horrible things occur in families over money. So obviously, money is a very real issue, but judges in these dehydration cases don't seem to care about it. I'll give you an example. There was a case in Michigan called Michael Martin. Michael Martin was able to nod his head yes and shake his head no, and there was substantial evidence that he had indicated a desire to live. He certainly was not unconscious. There was no question about that. The judge admitted that from the bench. He seemed to like music and watching television and so forth. Still, the judge ordered him dehydrated at the request of his wife, even though the wife had lovers, and even though the wife would benefit financially from the killing. Michael Martin was not killed, only because the Michigan Supreme Court said that the wife had not proved by clear and convincing evidence that he would have wanted it. Had she been able to do it, the dehydration would have occurred, even though he was conscious. This is the next step. Right now, the bioethicists have been unable to get courts to allow conscious people to be dehydrated when there's a contest. And that's why the Robert Wendland case I talked about in Stockton has taken on such importance. There's a great deal of effort in that case because they lost in the Michael Martin case in Michigan to get this man, this poor man whose only crime is to be brain damaged, to be make him dead. And that is an ongoing process. It's on appeal at the moment. Actually, the judge in the trial court ruled against the dehydration because he said that he didn't have the right as a trial judge to make that choice, that it should be a decision for the legislature or a higher court. That was the right decision for that judge to make, and it's currently on appeal. By the way, Robert Wendland had a public defender representing his interests who decided that she thought he should die, and I've never heard of it before, but a public defender was arguing very emotionally, I was in the courtroom, for the killing of her own client. And now, in the appeal, the judge has allowed the county of San Joaquin's money, $50,000 worth, to go to an appellate lawyer whose job is to get Robert Wendland dead. Imagine that.
We may very well be heading, in terms of medical care, to the Ministry of Life, which would, of course, in Orwellian terms, be the Ministry of Death.
You're absolutely right.
Last couple of minutes here, Wesley. We're almost out of time. A lot of people are afraid of suffering in agony for a long period of time. Granted, that's redundant. But you point out that palliative care can relieve even the most extreme suffering and cite a bone cancer, terminal bone cancer case as exemplary.
Well, what is not being told people that is being covered up in this, hue and cry over killing, is that medicine has advanced tremendously in the ability to control pain and symptoms. When Jack Kevorkian killed the man on 60 Minutes, Jack Kevorkian told Mike Wallace that it was either that or this man would have to choke to death. Mike Wallace, who is a pro-euthanasia advocate himself, didn't bother to check to see whether or not that was true. In fact, it was a lie. It was false. ALS patients, and it's a very devastating condition, but ALS patients, when they receive appropriate medical care, do not choke to death and do not suffocate. But you would not have known that listening to 60 Minutes or watching 60 Minutes, because Mike Wallace wasn't interested in that issue. He was interested in promoting killing as an answer to ALS. Cancer. 95% of all cancer pain can be eliminated according to all the medical literature. It isn't being eliminated because doctors aren't treating it properly. Doctors do not have the appropriate training in pain control. 50% of cancer pain is undertreated or untreated. I have a good friend of mine who was dying of colon cancer, and when I went to visit him and pay my respects, he was in terrible pain, and I said, why aren't you on morphine? And it turned out he was on codeine. His oncologist put him on codeine for cancer throughout his body. Codeine barely takes care of a toothache. That is not to say, now, so people are dying in agony.
Right.
But it's not because they have to die in agony. It's because we're allowing them to die in agony.
Mm-hmm.
The answer to that problem isn't killing. The answer is improving medical care, as the AMA is beginning to do. There are a lot of initiatives now out to improve the delivery of palliation. Assisted suicide and euthanasia would be to surrender to that problem instead of solve it. In the Netherlands, palliation is stunted compared to Britain. Why? Because in the Netherlands, you don't have to worry about palliation since you kill patients. In Britain, you don't kill patients, and therefore, Britain was where the modern hospice movement got going. I just returned from Britain for my new book on bioethics, and I interviewed Dame Cicely Saunders, who is the creator of the modern hospice movement, and talked to her medical director and got all the straight scoop on what can be done to help dying patients not suffer. No ALS patient needs to choke, she told me, as did Dr. Sykes. No ALS patient needs to suffocate. No cancer patient needs to writhe in pain.
Wesley, we are all out of time here. Let's take this up at greater length in our next interview.
It'd be my pleasure.
All righty. We've been speaking with Wesley J. Smith, the author of Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder, published in hardcover by Times Books, copyright 1997. Wesley, thanks so much for visiting with us.
My pleasure.
For Wesley Smith, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.